Hello, my friends. Welcome to Let's Talk. My name is Shay Marville, and I think one of the most important skills in this world is being able to have a conversation with a friend or a foe. Let's Talk is a podcast about listening, growing, connecting, and hoping through compassion and talking. And I mean really talking about the good things and the hard things, and with remarkable people living in a remarkable time. So let's talk. Hello, my friends. Welcome to Let's Talk. On today's episode, I have a very special guest. He was once my professor in drama school at York University 20 plus years ago. His name is Sasha Lukacs. He is a globe-trotting director, writer, teacher, provocateur of dark comedy. And I think for anyone who is exploring storytelling and the value of theater right now, I think his kind of teaching, his way of teaching is so enlightening. And I hope that everyone that's listening understands that, especially right now, telling your story, sharing your perspective, listening to the stories of others is part of how we heal through this transformative time. Sasha, welcome to Let's Talk. So let's talk.
Glad to be here. So excited.
So how are you? How are you coping with teaching during a pandemic?
Well, listen, I've spent in this circumstance almost a year and a half on Zoom with my hundreds of students.
Yes.
And it's been, you know, a blessing that we have this thing in this technology in this time, because we would have just shut down, obviously.
Completely.
So I'm very grateful. I know a lot of people talk about Zoom fatigue and this and that, you know, yeah, which is all natural in this kind of crisis. But on the other hand, you know, thinking, this is one thing that I always try to make a point that with my students as well. There are so many people in this world who have it much worse than
me. Yes, totally.
So be sitting at home, having a job, you know, being able to click on a button and get 25 students on, you know, is a blessing. There's no two ways about it. I mean, all things considered, obviously.
Of course.
I'd rather be in class and sort of feeling that energy and being able to direct the students more, you know.
Yes.
Movement and all that stuff. But I'm really, really happy. And, you know, it looks like we're going to be soon out of it.
True. We're in Ontario here. And I think I've heard that we've had the longest kind of lockdown multiple long lockdowns. So who knows who any of us are anymore. But I was curious to know what it's like to go from being a teacher who's very action oriented and emotes a lot in a class to now being on Zoom. And what you have learned about teaching theater in this way?
Yeah. So listen, you know, first of all, thank you for the kind words in the beginning. I think that what I've managed to do is, you know, that my first love is directing, obviously.
Yes.
And directing really, in my mind, entails that kind of transfer of energy, and that you are, first of all, you're the one who's enthusiastic about the project, then you transfer that to your actors and collaborators, designers, and so on and so on, and hopefully to the audience as well.
Yes.
So when I, you know, I just transferred that sort of principle to my teaching. So the energy is always crucial, and a lot of times, you know, that your students are coming in with their doubts, and a lot of them have doubts expressed by their parents and people,
yes,
helping them pay for the tuition if they are, and, you know, telling them that there's no career and job,
yes,
opportunities, which is all pretty much partially true. At least. So you know, you have to explain yourself and tell them why are they there, and how do you help them in that context, right?
Yes.
So I think that number one, if they see somebody who's a relative adult, which is me, you know, being enthusiastic about this job, sort of gives them at least some food for thought. And going like, why is this guy so happy in this class, even though we're not going to be even producing a show,
but yes, he's
teaching us some monologues or scenes and so on. So number one, I think, is that energy, and that energy stems from the general love for theater, for acting, for performing arts and so forth, right? So that's number one. And then when you put it in Zoom, we were kind of instructed by IT people that, you know, 3 hours is a very long period of time to keep people in Zoom. So we tried to break it down, shorten it a bit, go for about 2 hours, and then give them some tasks to sort of address afterwards. But it's energy, you know, you need. So I just went full tilt and just wanted to see what their responses are. And I have to tell you, my classes have been packed all for the summer ago, and then all winter and fall. And now I'm teaching, if you can believe it, 8 classes this summer in both terms. So that's basically 7 and 8. So I'm teaching 15 classes.
Oh my God.
They're coming. And, you know, I think, first of all, we have a large number of students from abroad.
Yes, yes.
You know, that York has been expanding that way.
Yeah.
So I have a whole bunch of students, particularly in China.
Really interesting.
And that puts you into a completely different than time frame, because they're 12 hours apart.
So that's right.
Morning class, they're at 8. But I have probably 10 to 15 students who are doing it during the night in their time.
Yes.
So taking like a 2:30 class our time, it's 2:30 in the morning, and they finish around 4:35 in the morning over there. So it's really bizarre, you know, when you talk to somebody and I have like a window that's daylight and sunshine, and then you look behind them and they're in this kind of little hub, you know, and it's dark.
It's dark, yes.
Yeah. And I had quite a lot of students also in quarantine, because they would move midway through the term and then tell me, listen, I'm going to be in a hotel, just excuse the Wi-Fi and so on.
Right, right.
These generic spaces that they're kind of waiting for permission to leave and then go into a different, you know, wherever, house, apartment, and so on. So it's been an adventure, because all of a sudden you have an insight that you don't have in class, by the way.
Right, to their life, to their life.
To their life, their surroundings, so on. I had a student who was actually locked down in Yemen for about 3 weeks, who couldn't leave, and he's from Saudi, and then he had to go. It was just this
odyssey.
Know, go to Sudan, fly out, and then, because he couldn't go, obviously, from Yemen to Saudi because of the war and all of this stuff. So you're watching somebody who's on unlimited, even electric power, came there to help his grandmother, and still taking the course. And then you're going, you know, following him to some hotel in some other country before he went back to Saudi. So he finished the course at his home there. And you kind of go, I was in the same chair this whole time. In these 12 weeks, he managed to cross half of the world, and in relatively and not so relatively dangerous circumstances. So, you know, you're looking at that, but you're also measuring what kind of impact that has on other students.
Right. Oh, interesting.
You know what I mean? Because I ask them constantly, how's it going? You know, do you have food? How are you walking around? Because Yemen is a chaos, as you know.
Yes, yes.
So it was really, I think, extremely informative for people to sort of all of a sudden go, oh my God, I'm sitting here, you know, eating cookies, and somebody's, you know, on a little, basically, I don't even know how Wi-Fi functioned, and just like very, very, you know, dire circumstances. And he, you know, he held his own, he performed, I hope that the course was a distraction, you know, mm-hmm. that at some point that this was like his window of being out of that circumstance.
Right. I have a question. Yeah. Why do you think, I have a question, like I'm not going to have any questions. I'm sorry.
Yeah, of course. Go ahead.
Why do you think students are so motivated right now to study theater?
Well, I think that it's because it's a really quick way of responding to our outside circumstances. You know, I was always telling my students earlier, before social media, before YouTube and so on, you know, you have a political event or a catastrophe of some sort. It takes 2 years to make a compelling movie about it. Nobody's going to come out with a camera, have a ready script, you know, and go. Or the money construct, blah, blah, blah. Theater, you can build on the street and immediately perform 2 days after this thing happened. During the day, you can improvise. So there's this immediacy that's extremely, I think, valuable in theater performance as such, right? That you can, whatever is happening now, you can digest and sort of spew out onto a live audience. And a lot of particularly socially active and ambitious theater would do that, you know, in street where there were protests, where there were different kinds of, I mean, across the world, obviously.
Of course.
Latin America is particularly big on that kind of theater. And you know, where you have that immediate sort of response to things. So I think that it's kind of this, the quickness of digesting something and the outside sort of incoming information and experience, and then being able to sort of throw that out there as a response, as a mirror to that, which sort of, since Shakespeare fancies it to be a mirror of life, right?
So right.
Give you that kind of idea.
Do you think that this moment that the globe is going through, where we all are having this, you know, although differently, we're having this collective experience, that theater becomes like this catharsis, or not just theater, but stories?
Yeah. That would be very, I'm an idealist, and I would tend to agree with you. We're in such a broken, at once we're unified by the pandemic, but we're also hugely divided. And we're divided by the experience of it, by the unfortunate politicizing of particularly the vaccines, the masks, the behaviors. You've seen what's been going on in Canada and to a much higher degree United States. I'll tell you, I'm in touch with a lot of my friends in former Yugoslavia, particularly in Serbia. And, you know, here's a country that has done many weird things in the past, but I'm not going to remember them, but has done phenomenally well in the vaccination. So they have four different vaccines available for everybody. They started off, you know, out of the gate, getting the Chinese, the Sputnik, the Pfizer, the Astra, like everything was in place. Huge sports halls with the facilities, all of that stuff.
Unbelievable.
To the point where roughly around half of the people refuse to take the vaccine. And so this is dark comedy to me. You have all the countries in the neighborhood have no vaccines, and they've been giving them the vaccines, not selling. They gave Czech Republic, which is usually considered a much more organized society and so on, without war, 100,000 vaccines in the past week and a half. They've given Bosnia, Macedonia, all of these places that had no vaccines at a time. Mm. Whether it's for political points or not, these vaccines are going into somebody's arms and saving people, right?
Right, right. Now,
meanwhile, the president in Serbia has to pay people to get vaccinated in the neighborhood of $50 a shot. They have organized seminars. Okay, this is the common part. There's a seminar going on in the capital of instructing people how to de-chip themselves from the vaccine. It was sold out within an hour.
Oh my God.
My friend in Tanzania, who is a translator for United Nations and so on, and she's there on a mission with her partner and so on. And she told me that they're staying within a UN compound because the government does not acknowledge COVID, which means they're not allowing people to wear masks and they demand that you shake hands. And this has been going on since last winter.
So this is a situation where
it's surreal. You know, you're looking at this and their president, by the way, died from COVID.
Yeah. Yes, I know.
And said, you know, we have mantras and rituals to stave away the virus. And you're going like, this is weird. Like, I don't, you know, for whatever reason. So, you know, you are right. We are united in some way as humanity, but it also shows you how different we are and what kind of I don't know what this phenomena is, but you know, it's like what was happening during the insurrection, what was happening.
Yes.
You're getting this kind of really, really weird set of responses that people are now talking, oh, it was just a tourist walk through the Capitol. You know, you're going like, what?
What? No, I think it's people's experiences. So wherever the virus, the pandemic, you know, the story has met you, your experience and that lens, and whether you're in denial or whether you feel like you're an empowered human being or not, is how you receive the information. And it is very, I mean, even in families, you know, people are divided. And listen, you know, as you know, my personal story of losing my mom to COVID, and like, she wasn't a sick person and it happened like in 18 days. It was at the beginning, it's insane what happened with her. But even with that story, I meet people all the time who will, I mean, not outside, but, you know, over Zoom, and who, you know, will say, I'm not sure I'm going to get the vaccine. And so I always kind of coach myself into being, you know, always respectful and trying to be also, you know, hey, you know, I respect where you're coming from, but just, you know, I'm just going to encourage you, look at the facts, look at the science. You know, that's, there's no politics in that. And then just protect yourself best you can, that, you know.
Well, listen, I'm first of all, I'm very sorry for your loss. And we did communicate after that, but always needs to be acknowledged. But
I'll tell you
one thing. I have a very good friend back in Serbia who's a choreographer. Who's a couple of years older than me, but still very active, does Tai Chi every day, you know, all of that.
Yes.
He spent 3 weeks on a respirator, and he was literally, you know, he says, I was just sitting there trying to pray and basically being my, you know,
yes,
that sort of spiritual strength way.
Yes.
He was in a room with about, I don't know, 8 people.
Wow.
Over the course of 3 weeks, 7 people died in his room while he was sitting in the room. And he was telling me this, you know, this horrific experience of being there, where all of a sudden a hush falls over the room because it was chaos. They didn't have enough doctors coming that don't have any kind of longer and on, you know, disease experience, coming from trauma, coming from neurological, whatever.
Yes.
And they were just rushing to help, right? And so he says, you know, in this chaos, all of a sudden he says there's a silence in the room.
Mm.
And he's like, I don't know what. And then they turn around and this old lady just passed.
And
his soul kind of in his mind, you know, his soul just went. And he said, this happened 7 times.
Oh my.
And yet people are in denial. They're calling it a teeny flu. The theaters are open in Serbia. I was just actually, yesterday I was posting a regular Instagram post of my students saying goodbye for the first term. And somebody, you know, from Serbia commented, oh, you guys are still in Zoom. We're back to normal. And I'm going like, you, sure, good, you know, good luck with that.
Yes. I know you, It's wild. I don't even know what to say about it. I mean, I think this is the kind of thing maybe in a couple of years, we will be able to say, you know, what we went through and who was doing what and what meant what. But we're just in this collective, I think, transformation. And I think that's one of the reasons why storytelling, theater, experiences that allow you to feel something are so essential. And I guess what I'm wondering about your classes is, you know, is this a different kind of therapy for a lot of people, like being able to study, you know, the words and ideas and then take them out, even if it's over Zoom, and do something with it.
Absolutely. And we have this new component now where people are twice before we start getting to the monologues and actually, you know, doing somebody else's texts. Students are encouraged to tell us their own stories.
Yes.
And this is where I found out things like the Yemen story and you know, there was the Beirut bomb that exploded, or, you know, just a couple of months ago.
Yes, yes.
Three students from there and so on. So it really felt like we were communicating on a very, even though we were so far apart because of Zoom and all of that stuff, but that there's this intimacy happening and mm-hmm. sort of, you know, almost like a confessional type of dynamic where you have people telling you their most intimate stories, experiences, you know, starting with whatever political or, you know, mm-hmm. or COVID related issues to things that are, they may not be related, but are sort of equally as powerful. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden you're in a situation, because I mean, our logic obviously is that you're starting from yourself. So you're looking for that emotion and the emotional impact you can have on others in what's stored inside of you, then you take that and theoretically apply it to a character in a play and so forth. But I think that what was really, really precious for me was, see, I'm learning still, obviously. I know that sounds mm-hmm. like a cliche, but
no.
You know, all of a sudden you're hearing these stories that are completely, you know, unaltered. They seem to be coming in much more directly to you because you don't have the class dynamic.
Yes.
You know, we're all sitting in some kind of a semicircle and all this stuff. All of a sudden, it's just me and the camera and people are telling. And when you know very well that if you're in a group, it's very hard to gauge the reactions of other people.
Yes.
So you're
yes.
basically talking to yourself in a way. And that brings out a different tone, a different quality of that sort of confessional, right?
Right.
So, because I think it's far less self-conscious, if you will.
Right, right. What drove you into theater and wanting to be a director?
Okay, I was a child actor.
Well, and it's not just theater, it's the kind of theater, you know, Bertolt Brecht, like it's this,
yeah,
this really, this dark comedy that you, at least 20 years ago when, you know, when I first met you, that you were really engaged in. And I was always curious about what drew you to that.
Well, I'm still in that sort of realm of
yes.
dark comedy and dark political comedy and so on. And unfortunately, the world keeps providing us, just like what I was telling you, the yeah. deep living moment. I could make a whole play out of that.
I'm looking forward to it.
Just that. I have a dentist in Toronto who is from my country who refuses to get a vaccine. And not only that, but has patients who don't take the vaccine and who have developed COVID and are now accusing his hygienist of giving them COVID because they were vaccinated. So this, the lunacy of the world is precious. I mean,
yes,
I know it's very dangerous and so on. So for me, you know, I grew up in a communist system, as you well know, and with all of its benefits and its negative sides. Early on in my career, I think what a great motivator was to find ways of sending a message out there that would not be obvious, so that you get punished for it or whatever, and that but that the message is still out there. Mm-hmm. So the great thing about these kind of systems also is that your audience is only twofold. Either they're completely on the side of the system,
yes,
or they are rejecting the system. So you have your preaching pretty much to the converted, because everybody is not, you know, it's like the Soviet samizdats, you know, the books that were published under in basements and so on.
Right, right.
The audience that searches for them already knows what they want to read, right?
Precisely.
So for me, that was a great impetus to develop this language and, you know, this kind of secret or semi-secret way of communicating with an audience that wanted to hear, that was hungry to hear a fresh idea or a free idea, if you will, and so on. So there was, you know, the excitement of that is something that you don't usually feel in Canadian theater.
I was going to ask you exactly that, actually.
Because you once you witness that,
yes,
you feel so liberated. This is what the catharsis that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. As an audience member, I saw quite a lot of shows that influenced me, obviously, but that, you know, that you jump up in at the end and you applaud and yell and cry. I remember yes. watching this Hungarian show during communism in Canada,
subliminal.
Are you listening? That came from a very communist and restrictive Hungary at the time. And I remember sitting beside somebody who was just, I barely knew as an actor. And after the show, we cried and hugged each other. I don't know if you can imagine, it's like winning, you know, Stanley Cup or whatever.
The lottery, yeah.
Watch the show. Right. And so the emotions that were coming out of that, because they were enhanced by the fact that we were watching Forbidden Fruit and so on.
Yes. Yes.
That you had this exceptional sort of a catharsis that we were so excited to be in it. And so then to answer your question, coming here is a complete shock, because you don't have a unified audience. Mm-hmm. You have audience that comes in with completely different agendas, with different histories of watching theater.
Yeah.
And theater is not obviously as popular as it is in Eastern Europe and so on.
Right.
So people are sort of puzzled by you know, a turn in the play, because it's not Broadway-ish, you know.
Right.
And so, as you said, Bertolt Brecht asking questions rather than feeding answers to the audience, right? And it's a shock, because all of a sudden you think you know what you're doing, mm-hmm. and what the audience is going to be appreciating about the show. And then you start getting these weird answers or weird responses. And it was, I still haven't learned how to deal with that. I just decided at one point that I'm too old of a dog to learn new tricks. So I just come out and punch my way through the show and then see what happens. But I don't know if I ever told you, speaking about that audience response. I'm sorry, I'm not letting you ask a single
No, question. I love this. This is great.
But I don't know if you, I've done some shows at Glendon that yes. were interactive shows.
Yes. Yeah, I did see.
Yeah.
I did see.
And
yeah.
That was something that was an eye opener for me.
Oh, why?
Well, because we did political shows. We did, the first one was about Occupy movement, mm-hmm. which people have now largely forgotten, unfortunately, because it was all of 8 years ago. So we did a show that was written by the students and so on. And then after that, I did 100 years of in 2014, I did a sort of anniversary of the First World War.
Yes.
And I wanted to see and explore what the collective memory of that event is. It was a huge event, and 100 years have passed, and we've had a million wars since. Mm. But I wanted to see, you know, were there grandparent stories or great grandparent stories in families? Did somebody have somebody who died, et cetera, et cetera?
Yes, yeah.
And then I did the final one. I did Life is a Dream, which is an old Spanish play, but we turned it into a modern play.
Right.
Playing with the idea of what is a dream and so on and so on. And it was also extremely political. But the important part was that it was basically we had it on YouTube live. So the audience was in the house, but also watching from across the world.
Mm.
We had people in Hong Kong, in Serbia, in Texas, in Vancouver, like all over the place watching. And they had the ability to text us and comment on the show live.
Oh, my Lord.
And we had the actors and the audience that was in the house able to respond. And all of it was projected on these big screens in the play itself.
How do you control that? How do you control?
You don't. That's the whole point. My, you know, because we, after the first show, there was a lot of really weird content, as you can imagine, some verging on pornography and so on, because people love sitting in their basements and going, oh, you're having a public show. We had Hitler babies. We had the working. Like, people would just, especially with gifts, you know, they would send you stuff, and it just appears, and then it comes rolling down, and then you have extremely compassionate discussions about the play itself that are between people who, like, I had a person from Australia communicating with somebody from Serbia, and they were from the same place, but had obviously developed completely different
lives.
So all of a sudden you and these conversations would kind of twirl, and then somebody would post something disgusting or whatnot. But the point is, if you control social media and filter it, then there's no point in social media, obviously.
No.
So, you know, I just said, okay, so my show is a provocation. And then we'll see what we catch as, you know, what fish fly into our net. And it is bizarre because all of a sudden, you know, I had a feeling that before that theater has this amazing power to, as you say, to unify the audience and have this kind of even response, or at least the response that's on some level, let's say socially conscious, if it's a political play, et cetera, et cetera. People were commenting on, oh, that actress has great legs, to whatever, you know, to mocking the political message, to making really, and to me, once I sort of put my ego and vanity on the side,
I
realized that actually it's a precious experience, because you finally understand what your audience is actually thinking about while you're providing them with this provocation of some kind of social agenda, or
that you
all of a sudden see people who don't care,
right,
or are offended by the fact that theater dares take itself so seriously that they will teach us something or write the discourse or whatever. So their reasoning then becomes, well, watch me now, I'll put a damper on that.
Exactly. And, that's interesting.
You know, yeah, because they're under handles. You're not, I don't care. I'm not going to chase anybody and go, aha, you said something bad. But it was just a flurry. We had probably per show 1,000 to 1,500 messages coming in.
See, and if you had like a show at the Fringe, right? Like years ago, you would never have that many people interacting in one event.
Absolutely not. So this is an attempt, you know, to kind of bring in the social media into the live performance. Because, you know, I was saying how theater responds quickly to whatever is happening outside. Social media does that even faster.
Right.
And you'll post a video from a protest before anybody can utter a word about it and so on. Of course, it's unfiltered and so on. But I was trying. And you know what was the biggest problem, actually, what I encountered because I was trying to promote this as an idea with professional theaters.
Right, right.
The problem is equity and actress.
Right.
Basically, the moment you would put this on any kind of performance on YouTube, it becomes already a public performance, and that's,
yes,
the actors need to be compensated for
it. Right.
So that's the big sort of, but I'll tell you, when we were doing the show, we had a whole bunch of people who kind of, you know, Canadian Opera Company people coming in and sneaking, you know, trying to figure out
how can they pull some of this into their own?
Yeah. Well, they did something with Twitter and trying to have a live response, but they wouldn't show the performance.
Of course.
The performance is really the key, because then we all know what we're talking about.
Right.
Nonsense, or if your response is just crazy.
Do you feel constrained in the Canadian theater marketplace, like the theater of ideas here? Like, is it more constraining than in Europe?
That's a weird thing to answer, because I honestly, in the 20 some years that I've been here, I never really became part of Canadian theater. A number of shows, I really don't feel that I belong in any way. You know, I've started with a student of mine from Glendon, by the way.
Yes.
In college, we started a theater in Barrie, which is very successful now. It's called Talk is Free Theater. And my ex-student is doing some wonderful work. He took two of my productions to Europe on tour. And you know, so they're very, from a small city like Barrie, like not
yes.
and so on. But
Barrie has a really great theater community, though.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Large part of it is Skiz Theater.
Yes.
And he's been doing full seasons for the past, well, it's going to be 20 years next year. So we did our first show in 2002 there. And it was, you know, very sort of, we just put together stuff and there was not much money and so on. But and here's another sort of little anecdote about Canadian theater. For a theater that's starting, the first show, we had 800 submissions of resumes from actors trying to get in on the show for 8 roles, by the way. So to give you an idea, you know. But as I said, it's really funny. And then I started going back to Serbia to do shows.
Yes, yes.
And I've done some really, to me, very, very dear shows and interesting work and so on. But, you know, I haven't been there in 14 years and I come every 2 years to do a show. I'm out of that place as well.
Right, right.
Things, people that I knew are kind of retiring and, you know, they're sort of have memories of our great work back in the day. I could sit with a plum brandy and, you know, do you remember this one or that one? Right? But it's really, it's hard. So I find myself actually in between two worlds.
Yes. Yeah. Kind of an outlier in a way, right? But I just feel like, you know, maybe something's opening here, because I think the theater community here, like the established one, is narrow. There's many, many people that it doesn't include, and that means stories.
Exactly, exactly. You're right. But you see, this is one of the problems, and I think I wanted to write a show years ago about stuff that I saw on the street around the native centers and so on,
mm-hmm.
and stuff that really shocked me and put me in kind of what the heck, because I was always, you know, back home, I was doing shows about people who are underprivileged, who are having,
yes.
you know, all kinds of, and so on. So I wanted to do a show about that. And then I had several friends who were in various kinds of political theater companies and so on. who told me, oh no, you can't do that because you're appropriating a voice.
Right.
So, you know, and I said, okay. I find myself as a person of the world and a humanist. And
yes. You know,
so I think that I should be able to say things about when I see injustice and so on.
Yes.
Okay, fine. I think some of that is hitting us back very harshly now when you discover what's been going on.
Exactly. Exactly.
Years, but we wouldn't touch it, right?
Right, right.
So then I see, and that's a partial hypocrisy, I see a whole bunch of theater companies doing shows about war in Sarajevo, which is my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, excuse me, are you appropriating now some, you've never been there. What are you doing? So now all of a sudden you watch these artists who kind of find a little break in, oh, we can get funding if we're doing a show about blah, blah, blah.
Right.
You know what I mean? And all of a sudden all these little socially conscious, etc., shows started popping out, and I started asking myself, okay, so is this a major hypocrisy, or as you say, so hopefully that things are changing and that people are more open to hearing stories from, you know, from different places?
Or are people just understanding what, you know, the monetization process is and where they're going to get, you know, the funding, which is, you know, and I think this is the challenge in Canada. You're constantly trying to figure out, you know, how can I pay for something versus, you know, the value of sharing it because it's just something important to share. But I don't know. I think also that just one of the great benefits of human beings who have a theater kind of mindset is that they see what is unseen and then they find a way to share it or show it through language, through body, through something. And we need that. And I think the people who need to do it, no matter whether they can afford it or not, just keep doing it. But it's a struggle.
It is a struggle. And I'll tell you the other problem that again, and I'm going to step on way too many feet now, but you know me, sometimes.
I like that. Do it.
I just find that, you know, when somebody catches a break and does a show about, let's say, some political issue, whatever it is.
Yes.
And all of a sudden that becomes the be all of and all of that issue.
Yes, yeah.
You come in from the outside and say, great, but this show could also blah, 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 right?
Yes.
You're also all of a sudden not taking it as 100% fantastical because, you know, we still have ways to go. Just, you know, it's like saying, oh, racism is bad. Oh, thank you, Sasha. We get it.
Yeah.
Can we progress that issue a little more? Because we've known that for decades and should have known this for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. But people then kind of go, but I did a politically correct show. So you can't question me. You can't put a, you know what I mean?
You can't have a dialogue about it. But it's because we can't have... And I think that's what I'm trying to evolve with this show in a way is I want people to talk, and you don't always have to agree with the person you're talking to. And you may talk to them and you may also leave the conversation not agreeing, but still you created space for having the conversation.
That's the power of an intellectual discourse. If you're all agreeing and we're only talking to people that we agree with 100%, this society is doomed because we're not, you know, this is where it's really challenging when you start hearing other nonsense.
Yes. Yeah. So
then it's very hard. Like, you know, laser beams starting fires in California, you go, I don't know what to do with that. How do we open a discussion with that? Then, of course, we make that mistake and call that person an idiot and so on. Then they clamp down and come up with Holocaust theories that are...
Yes, know, yeah. Or they go, or worse, they go underground.
Well, exactly.
And then they start cultivating these little, like, circles of people who share the same ideas but don't share it.
And you sort of go, I don't, but it's so, you know, it's a huge challenge.
It's huge. You know, something that was very meaningful to me that we did 20 plus years ago was
one man
it was
a couple years ago,
you know, forget the zero. It was the Bertolt Brecht story about the actor who was a Nazi.
All right. Right.
And you're not going to remember this because there was so much going on, but there was a character where he was having a relationship with an African woman, or no, African German woman,
yes,
who was a prostitute.
Yes.
Right. And I played the prostitute and I was very conflicted about that. And we had a number of conversations, you and I, and then as a group, mm-hmm, about the role, because some of my interpretation of it was from a North American perspective, mm-hmm, of blackness and about, you know, being a woman, and then I found playing the role to be very liberating.
Yes.
Right. And it was a really truly powerful experience for me, not because I was going to be an actor, but as a person, beholding some other character, you know.
I still remember the red boots. So it was 2 years ago, I'm telling you.
It was yeah. 2 years ago.
I'll tell you one thing. First of all, that show is, and there's a movie, obviously.
Yes, of course.
Mephisto.
Yes.
And it is based on a true story, by the
way. Yeah.
So that whole relationship that the Heinrich Hofgen or Gunther something now, but it was written by his brother-in-law and then turned into a play. And,
yes.
You know, showed this opportunist who started off as a socialist cabaret performer, who quickly turned into fiery Nazi supporter and had a phenomenal career in Nazi Germany. He was their go-to, you know, he played Mephisto, and all of that stuff.
Yeah, he was their star, their celebrity.
And this is something, you know, the hypocrisy of our world, right? And you'll find that through history, wherever you look, people who propagate one idea and this kind of pure blah blah blah,
and
have the secret life, you know, that you sort of go, are you kidding?
Exactly.
Are you kidding? You know, so that was, I think, the primary point of that. And of course, you know, the idea is that you as an actor have to go behind the character you were playing and trying, mm-hmm, to figure out what was her stance and what,
yes,
was her logic. And did,
yes,
she actually love this man on some level?
Yeah.
Or was this just an, you know, thing of interest? And then how did she deal with the fact that she was never publicly addressed as a character in his, or as a relationship in his
life? Yes.
So these are all the questions that's exactly what I'm saying. Opening up that discourse, right? And
yes.
Playing hypocrisies where they appear and so on. He survived the war. Nothing happened. Like,
I know.
Kept on being an actor, you know?
After
the war.
I just think like sometimes, you know, when you look through the lens from a different cultural point of view and you try to be whoever that person was, and all their experiences that led up to their life, then you have a different idea about why that would even be an option. Why did she make those choices? Why, you know, like it was just so transforming, that process of learning and going behind the scenes and trying to imagine what her life was and his life. Anyways, I'm so grateful to you for that. And I think one of the things that you do as an educator is that you bring other, like really bring other points of view to the table, and the table is often already set. And then you say, No, actually, I'm going to sit underneath the table. I want to tell you why, or I'm going to go and hang from the chandelier and I want to tell you what I see from here. And I love that
Right.
about your
Well,
work.
I still remember your great performance, so congrats to you again. But you know that we had a very, and that's one of the great qualities, I think, of your universities, that we had such a diverse cast
We did.
coming from, and we were doing a very, very strong political
Yes.
play, which was talking about Holocaust, that was talking about anti-Semitism, that was talking
Yes.
about this racist
Yeah.
attitude that he had towards his lover, and so on and so on. So there was a lot of things to sort of,
Unpack.
devour. And with
Yep.
students who were mostly very young, and this was
Yes.
probably first or second experience with theater, and then sort of coming on stage and exposing their emotions and falling in love, being, with a character, and so on and so on. So
Yes.
there was a lot of that play particularly had so many different,
Elements
we
in,
had
yeah.
two women coming out and being in love. We had, the
Yes.
whole train going to Auschwitz. We had this situation. We had the Faust performance for the Nazis. There was a lot of stuff there that first of all, the students needed to digest. But that's where I don't make apologies. And I keep reminding my students today, look at our world. Like, you have so much more access. Even when we did our show those 2 years ago, we had
Yes.
far less access to
Huge.
information than today.
Absolutely. And
It's our duty to find out what's going on.
yes, yeah. Listen, I could talk to you for the rest of the afternoon. You're going to have to come back on the show
Okay,
and
gladly.
I'm so grateful and I'm just so appreciative. And please be well and continue your great work.
Thank you so much. And you continue your great work. You're bringing such an amazingly interesting, and a diverse group of people in your podcast that it's amazing.
Thank you for joining the conversation. We are growing an amazing community here at Let's Talk. Please share the show, make sure you're subscribing, and keep talking. And you can always reach out to me at CoachShayMarville.com or on Instagram at ShayMarville. Let's talk. Let's keep talking.